You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for coming to this event. I'm David Nather. I'm the healthcare editor at Politico Pro, and thanks for joining us to the latest event in the Brookings Institution series on Campaign 2012. This is a series of panel discussions that explore 12 of the most important issues that the next president is going to face. Our topic today will be healthcare and how should the next president address the challenges of the Affordable Care Act and the budgetary challenges of the healthcare entitlement programs as well. Joining us today are Alice Rivlin, who is the Office of Management and Budget Director under President Bill Clinton, also the co-author of the Domenici Rivlin deficit reduction plan produced by the Bipartisan Policy Center. Also joining us today is Ross Hammond, whose specialty is modeling social dynamics with a big focus on public health work. He's going to talk about the challenges the next president will face in finding ways to prevent obesity, which will be one of the biggest healthcare spending challenges to come. Also today, we're very lucky to be joined by Tom Mann, who has a wealth of expertise on Congress and has been well known for years in his work on the subject. He's just co-authored a new book with Norm Ornstein about the problems facing Congress right now with the extreme polarization that we're seeing. And finally, we're joined by Mark McClellan, the director of the Engelberg Center, whose specialty is finding ways to make healthcare cheaper and still better. And Mark, I wanted to ask you a little bit about a very generous gift that the Engelberg Center has just received to help its mission in a great way. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
David, thanks for being here and thanks for the opportunity. And today is a big day for us at the Engelberg Center, the Irene Diamond Fund for so set up by Irene Diamond has made a major contribution to the Engelberg Center, setting up both the Irene Diamond Fund for Healthcare Innovation and the Irene Diamond Fellowship for Public Health Leadership. This is a 5-year, $10 million gift to help support our efforts on reforming healthcare policies to improve care and lower costs, as you said. A big thrust of this initiative is going to be around public health, the kinds of issues that Ross and others have worked on, changing behavior and bringing that part of the big determinants of health more into the healthcare reform efforts. It'll include a lot of work with public health experts as well as traditional healthcare groups on hopefully on both sides of the aisle, hopefully for more of the kinds of bipartisan efforts that Tom keeps reminding us are very much needed these days. Mm.
It's wonderful, and congratulations, too.
Thank you.
It's quite an accomplishment. I'd like to start today by discussing the three issue briefs that are being released today that focus on the healthcare topics ahead. I'd like to start with Alice Rivlin's paper, which explores the path ahead on the Affordable Care Act and why the next president should look for ways to build on the Affordable Care Act and improve it, but not repeal it.
Right. Well, the signature achievement of the Obama administration in the healthcare area clearly is the Affordable Care Act. It was hard fought. It was not an attractive battle. It is one of the symptoms of the thing that Tom Mann has focused on, that our politics are very polarized. But it did pass, and it is, I believe, a very positive next step in the battle to get coverage for all Americans, especially those who do not have insurance, and those tend to be low-income Americans, though not covered by Medicaid, and some people who just don't want to buy insurance, but do end up needing health care and end up costing the rest of the system when they end up in the emergency room or whatever, guess what, you're not invulnerable. Many of them are young and not poor. They just don't want to participate in the insurance pool. But I think Americans believe in insurance. Most of us feel that health care is something that you should be able to afford when you need it. And the Affordable Care Act extended insurance to quite a large number of the uninsured, establishing exchanges, much like the system in Massachusetts under Romney's governorship, in which people who didn't have insurance could go to a well-structured exchange online and choose among plans that they had some information about, hopefully better and better information as the system progresses. Now, people who don't have much money, health insurance is expensive, have to have a subsidy to do that, and that is one of the main things the Affordable Care Act does. It establishes under state leadership the exchanges and then defines subsidies for people who need health insurance. And it also improves the health insurance market. Says that insurers can't refuse to insure people because they have some kind of prior condition or can't charge them more if they're sick than if they're healthy and other values in the insurance market. But that is going to cost insurance companies more money. So they're willing to go along with that if these other people who don't choose to buy insurance get into the pool. So the Affordable Care Act, therefore, had a mandate to buy insurance, which the Supreme Court is now looking at. Personally, I don't think if the mandate goes down, it will be too significant. That can be the law can be changed to essentially bribe people to buy insurance instead of forcing them to buy insurance and get more people into the pool. But perhaps mostly because of the polarization of our politics, no Republicans voted for the Affordable Care Act, and all of the Republican candidates have said they would repeal it. Now, what would happen if they did repeal it? It's not very clear, because the insurance reforms have already gone into place. The exchanges are getting up and running. So my hope is that the next president, whoever it is, continues to implement, perhaps accelerates the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and keeps it in the mix.
I wanted to ask you about one of the improvements that you suggest or additions that you suggested, sensible tort reform. Now, that can mean so many different things to so many different people, and you know the two parties have never seen anywhere close to eye on that, it seems. But I'd like to get your thoughts on what would be a sensible sort of middle ground on tort reform. What would be sensible policies that would make the law better?
Well, first, tort reform has been a very contentious issue, as you note. And it's also been exaggerated. The proponents of tort reform say it would make a huge difference in lowering the cost of medical care. There is very little evidence of that. Malpractice insurance is quite expensive for a subset of specialties. I'm looking down the line at Mark to see if he is, because he's more of an expert on this than I am. But it doesn't drive healthcare costs. Especially if you took the route of saying a doctor that is following accepted practice guidelines and there will be more and more of those as time goes on, has a safe harbor. He can use that as a defense. He did the thing that was the prescribed thing to do under these circumstances. That's one way to go. Caps on damages are another, though I think they're probably not the best way to go.
Okay. And lastly, before we bring the other panelists in, wanted to ask you a little bit about the budgetary challenges,
right,
because that will be the other big piece that the next president comes to. What's the most sensible path, in your view, for the next person in the White House, whoever it is?
I think we know what to do about our looming budget deficit or debt. The debt is on track to grow faster than our economy can grow. That is partly because of the growth of the entitlement programs, especially Medicare and Medicaid, because of the big bulge of retirees, the retirement of the baby boom generation, and the fact that health care, despite all efforts to bend the curve, is more expensive every year, and you multiply that by the number of beneficiaries, and you get federal spending rising faster than the economy can grow, and revenues don't. I've served on two commissions now. You mentioned Domenici Rivlin, but I also served on Simpson-Bowles. They came to roughly the same conclusion because the arithmetic drives you there. It's not a partisan thing. We can't solve this problem unless we do two things. One is reduce the rate of growth of health care spending, and there are different ways of doing that, but it's got to be part of the mix. And the other is raise more revenues, because we can't absorb this many older people and their health care without more revenues unless we're basically willing to close down the rest of the government. And there are things we need the government to do. So taking either the Simpson-Bowles or the Domenici-Rivlin or the Gang of Six or all of these proposals, which are all roughly the same, and putting together a bipartisan deal seems to me essential. The president knows that. He tried to do that in the negotiation with Speaker Boehner. It is, again, very difficult because the extremes in both parties are not very enthusiastic about tax increases on the Republican side or changes in Medicare and Medicaid on the Democratic side. But he's got to do that. I think everybody knows that. After the election, perhaps beginning in the lame duck session, I hope we will see a deal. It's got to be a bipartisan deal, and it's got to include entitlements and more revenue.
Okay, that sounds like a good note to bring in Tom and the paper that he's putting out today, which focuses on the polarization that we're seeing. I think Tom's point in all of this has been, you know, where's the bipartisanship that you can kind of hook onto? What, you know, where's the middle that you could look to for a deal like this? But Tom, I'd like to get your thoughts on what's doable and what's not.
Well, thank you. I have written just a brief response paper to Alice's paper, which is in part a description and support endorsement of the Affordable Care Act and a recommendation to strengthen it, especially its cost cutting measures. But secondly, the second part is really to understand the important dimensions of healthcare cost increases in the broader deficit and debt problem that confront the country. And the centerpiece of Alice's discussion of the latter, as far as this paper is concerned, is in part taken from the Rivlin-Domenici budget recommendations, but also makes reference to to Paul Ryan and Ron Wyden's new initiative. It's really built around the idea of a premium support for Medicare. And Alice is sort of very careful in talking about the conditions under which such a restructuring of Medicare, including the continuing option, you might call it a public option, for Medicare through traditional fee for service, and she recognizes fully the many elements of regulation that would be required to achieve such an effort. And I'm sort of with her. I've been a compatriot and an admirer of Alice's for many years, and I see where she's coming from. And it really is part of her broader effort over these years to grapple with the broader deficit and debt problems, and I applaud her for that. Alice says in the paper, there is no alternative to bipartisan consensus. And my argument here is bipartisan consensus is not an alternative. It's a pipe dream, given the current realities of American politics. And that the real danger is that Alice's support for a premium support system is adopted without her embrace of a retention and strengthening of the Affordable Care Act, without her admonition that taxes have to increase, despite her broader concern for social justice and the special health care problems of the disabled and of people with very low incomes. Because when you try to reach such an agreement with the contemporary Republican Party, there is no bargaining on the other side. And I mean, one illustration of the limits of bipartisan efforts to solve a whole range of problems really comes with health reform. Remember the bipartisan Policy Center's program for this. Baker, Dole, and Daschle, with George Mitchell off doing some diplomacy, enormous efforts with bipartisan staff to bring in the experts. Mark, my colleague here, put together a task force that included conservatives. And, you know, we've got all these former officials and scholars and think tankers. And, boy, they reached agreement. You know what? It was pretty damn close to what the Affordable Care Act was. And, you know, as Alice said, it got zero Republican votes in the Congress. In fact, many elements of the bill, which had been adopted from Republican alternatives or Republican plans in states such as Massachusetts, then was characterized as socialistic medicine. I mean, right there, it tells you this. If you begin with the presumption you can't get anything done without forging agreement between two parties, one of which is center-left and pretty pragmatic, and the other of which is now extremely ideological and strategic in its hyper-partisanship, which is built around the broader plans of architect and salesman Paul Ryan, who is one impressive and formidable salesman for his plan. But if you look at it, the broader plan includes a dramatic reduction in taxes and tax rates. I mean, there is a promise not to pay for extension of expiring tax cuts, but pay for the further reductions through, quote, tax reform. But that becomes a cover. We're all going to do that. We're going to lower rates and get rid of all of those destructive deductions and credits that stand in the way of economic efficiency. But alas, the biggest producing ones would be to make capital gains taxes about the same as ordinary income, and that is off the table, as many such other items are. It involves so dramatic cuts in taxes, increases in defense spending, the effort to contain Medicare budget, but not immediately, because politically that's radioactive. It's to phase it in with people who are now under 55 years of age, setting up a system of, call them whatever you want, vouchers or premium support, but it really is an effort to begin to put a cap on the spending, not as ACA does with an overall budget that then gets policed by an independent commission forcing Congress, hopefully, to act in ways to do it, but rather we presume over time either the benefits of competition among insurers will lower the cost and that will take care of it. If not, it's inevitable that the real value of those relative to healthcare costs will decline over time. And finally, and the most important, which we see unfolding now, is a series of block grants, especially for Medicaid, whose, I think, largest cost or one of its largest costs is long-term care. It's really quite extraordinary what is being proposed. And now, after the threat of a government shutdown and a default with the debt ceiling, agreement was reached, and now that, although signed into law, is being renegotiated, reset, and Ryan's Budget Committee right now is working on changing that and instituting much deeper cuts in means-tested programs and fewer, if any, reductions in defense spending, the sequestration part of it. Deeper cuts overall than call for in spending and a shift in a really dramatic way. It's possible that over time a premium support system would work for Medicare, but I sure wouldn't want to try it until we had seen how we did with the exchanges and ACA, how we do with much easier risk adjustment to keep insurers from cherry picking, and to see if individual consumers have enough discretion to choose plans that would actually lead to economies in the production of services when in fact those costs are highly concentrated among a minority of beneficiaries. So I think it's a real risk. I understand what Alice is proposing to do, but I think our politics right now argue against anything like that happening, and I think, and I sort of conclude, sorry for going on, is that the best way is not to begin with the necessity of a bipartisan agreement, but just the opposite, to say, no, we're going to lay out what we think makes sense. If the public doesn't rein in the insurgent outlier party and say, you know, that's an economic agenda for a country that renegotiates 100 years of policy. We don't want it. Until we get to that point and different Republican leaders emerge, we're not going to have any bipartisan consensus. So what do we do in the meantime?
Okay. So your prescription is a big Democratic win in November, retake all three branches of government, and then everything's okay.
teach those Republicans
is that
a
right?
lesson.
I know we're not allowed to say that. Now we're nonpartisan, bipartisan in the press and in the think tanks, even if we see a reality that's unbalanced, we got to say it's balanced, and they say this, and they say this. We have to say Republicans care as much about having universal health care coverage. They care as much about deficit reduction and deficits, and that their seeming emphasis on tax cuts aren't really that much of an obstacle. We can have tax reform and make everyone happy. Yeah, I think it'd be better if that happened this time around. Yeah, I believe in unified government. I think divided party government is horrible right now. It doesn't work with this degree of polarization. And it's almost certain that won't happen. But I don't think you improve the situation by going into the campaign, you know, sort of anesthetizing the public and saying, oh, it's the whole system, they're both at fault, we just need to bring them together. It seems to me that demobilizes the public and disarms them, and therefore it's better to talk straight, even if it's awkward.
I hope
you recognize that none of the things he just attributed to me were actually said.
No, I didn't. I'm not attributing them to you at all.
All right. I want to give Alice a chance to respond a little more in just a second. But I wanted to, and then I want to get Mark's take on the lay of the land on all this too. I just want to ask Tom one question. We've both been watching Congress for a long time, and they have actually gotten into this cycle where they just say, you know what, let's just take it to the voters. The second year of every election cycle, that's what they do. Let's let the voters settle it. And then it kind of happens over and over and over. So, you know, is it realistic to think that, that this can be a solution even in this kind of polarization? You know, even if we take your point that the parties are not equal and whatever, can we actually count on, you know, a decisive statement one way or another from the voters? Do we know that they're paying attention to the issues enough that that we can count on this to happen?
Of course not. We can't count on that at all. And you're quite right in pointing out the normal dynamics and routines of American politics, which work as so far as you have sort of two parties somewhat in, you know, the mainstream of American politics with clearly articulated differences of values and philosophies, but basically accepting the legitimacy of each other, of believing in facts and evidence and science, of being willing to engage in real collaboration. But if that doesn't happen, divided government is a disaster, and the voters ought to know that, and we ought to tell them and talk straight to them and not mesmerize them into thinking where it's, you know, a bipartisan agreement is around the corner. I think it's not. And just in terms of pure hardball politics, if Obama's reelected, even with a Republican Congress, he has one advantage, which is the status quo is unacceptable to the Republicans with all those tax cuts. Mind you, it's unacceptable to Obama, too, because of the immediate macroeconomic hit. But both of, you know, both now have some leverage, not just an opposition party willing to use the filibuster to kill or discredit or nullify every element that the majority was able to put into practice.
Okay, Alice, I'd like to give you a little more time. It sounds like there's a lot to dig into there.
Well, I don't want to take much time. I think my position is clear. I think on the question of the rising debt, we do need a bipartisan agreement. Maybe consensus is the wrong word. Maybe deal is the right word. But gridlock is actually not an acceptable answer when your debt is rising faster than your economy can grow. It's not an acceptable answer to climate change, for example, either. There are a lot of costs to gridlock, but the one that might have the most immediate consequences is not putting in place a long-run plan to curb the growth of debt. And I think that has to include taxes and entitlements, and therefore has to include both parties. I don't need to belabor that. Unless we have that deal, I don't think we get there. Now, on the question of controlling health care costs, there are lots of options. One is to do what is in the Affordable Care Act, which I support, which is to look for all the possible ways that we can deliver health care more effectively and more efficiently. And these are built into the Affordable Care Act. And then by regulation, use Medicare as the leader in getting those into place. Another way is to have organized competition on an exchange among capitated health plans that agree to take care of you for a year, and they have to take care of anybody who comes, and let them compete. Now, we already do this in Medicare Advantage. We don't have a very good structure for the competition. And all the proposal that Pete Domenici and I put together is organize an exchange that will improve the competition, but make it an option. It's an option now for keep regular Medicare as the default option. Everybody's in it unless they don't want to be, and provide this other option. I don't believe that's a pernicious or risky thing to do. It's saying there are two ways to go. We don't know which will work. Let's do both.
Okay, so let's do this. And poor Ross has been sitting here an awful long time, and I want to get to you in a second because Ross's paper looks at the obesity challenge. I want to give that a good focused discussion that it deserves in its own right. But I do want to ask Mark, who has been kind of watching this landscape for a long time too. What do you think is realistic on the Affordable Care Act, where we've seen the public get sort of completely dug into their positions, and there's doesn't seem like there's a lot of minds to be changed anymore on that. And what do we do to get that Medicare deal after, when is it possible to do that given the way that discussion has been going lately?
Sure, David. It's been interesting to watch the landscape generally, and also the landscape on this panel for the last half hour as well. So maybe I can provide a little bit of a different perspective. And I do want to get to what will or what may or may not happen with the ACA. It does depend because of the very strong differences in views across the parties about the ACA. It does depend a lot on what happens in the election, who wins the presidency, who wins control of the House and Senate. And there are going to be very different outcomes. But I don't think that takes away from the fact that despite the strong partisan and deep philosophical divides on the big issues related to the ACA right now, that both parties are going to have to work together in some important ways in working through some of the urgent problems related to our healthcare system. In that regard, there are a lot of Republicans, Tom, who do care about better care and lower costs and are trying to think hard about all of this and how to get there. And the action may not come from sort of a coming together philosophically about the future for our country, but more about, as Alice was saying, the necessity to make a deal. That's actually happening, believe it or not, on some healthcare issues right now. There will be bipartisan legislation on user fees for prescription drug innovation, for medical devices, for all kinds of other activities that the FDA regulates, because that's must-pass legislation to keep the FDA in business. And that's actually a really important piece of healthcare legislation because those drugs, those biologics, those medical devices are the future in terms of finding ways to deliver better care and better outcomes and maybe save money by preventing complications too. There will be bipartisan legislation on that because it has to happen. There will be bipartisan legislation of some form by early next year on physician payment reform in Medicare. We're in a situation now that we keep getting into year after year where the status quo of trying to save money by squeezing down prices more on doctors and Medicare isn't something that we can really follow through on. We've taken that string about as far as we can, and there are a lot of discussions going on right now between members on a bipartisan basis as well as their staffs on how to get out of that cycle. That doesn't mean it won't be easy to do, but there is some genuine engagement around payment reform in Medicare, building on a lot of steps that Medicare is taking now, took when I was there, to move away from, you know, I don't think you can really call it fee-for-service Medicare anymore, maybe traditional Medicare, but it's moving away from paying for volume and intensity and trying to move towards paying for better care and lower costs, in a lot of cases trying to emulate what's going on in the private sector or state or regional-based reforms too. So there, what these have in common is must pass and must find a way forward. Now, so that brings me to the ACA and the election, and it will be a different outcome depending on who wins. This election does matter for the future of the ACA, regardless, I think, of what the Supreme Court does. I mean, that's an important decision, but it's not going to be as dispositive as some of these other factors that I'm going to talk about right now. If the Republicans do sweep Republican presidency, President Romney, and Republican control of the House and the Senate, most of the ACA is likely to go the same way it came, via reconciliation, where with 50 votes plus one in the Senate, a majority in the House, signed by the President, any major provision that has significant direct federal budgetary implications can be removed. So what would be included there? Well, the individual mandate, again, regardless of what the Supreme Court does about it, that has significant budgetary costs, according to the Congressional Budget Office. I think it sounds like this is consistent with kind of Alice's view, is that, yes, having the mandate there does get more people in the pool, but if you don't have it, it's not that insurance markets won't exist at all. Premiums may be a bit higher, depending on how well you deal with adverse selection. Fewer people participating means fewer number of subsidies given out by the government means lower overall budgetary costs. So that provision can go. The subsidies for the exchanges would be significantly revised, if not removed. On the other hand, President Romney in the scenario has said that he favors giving individuals something like a credit, an amount of money that they could spend of their own choice to buy health insurance coverage, which might be a different form and in a different context than in the current ACA, but it's a move in that direction too. Another key provision is the Medicaid expansions, and that's something that states have said that they can't afford right now, so you could see that rolled back, and as Tom said, more of a push in the direction of block grants, overall amounts of money that are more controlled by the state, with the flip side that if the state finds a way to save money in Medicare and do what's necessary for coverage, then it gets to share in more of the savings. Right now, a lot of that doesn't go to the states, and so that's something that many Republicans view as leading to higher costs and more inefficiencies. I would say here, too, that even if the Republicans don't win, if you look at what's going on in Medicaid, both in terms of coverage through Medicaid managed care plans that are comprehensive and that get capitated payments on a per-person basis, and for dual-eligible Medicare beneficiaries who traditionally were part of a very fragmented Medicare and Medicaid fee-for-service system and have not been getting good care, as Melanie Bella and CMS said very eloquently recently, that program, too, is moving towards more integration and what may be more of a capitation focus, more of this notion of shared savings. So it may not get all the way to what, you know, sort of an extreme version that some have painted fixed amount of money, one Medicaid payment, but moving in the direction of some accountability for covering people, delivering good care, but more flexibility in how to get there and more opportunities for states to save along the way. That seems like where Medicaid is headed regardless of who wins, and maybe there'll be some differences of degrees in getting there. So in all of those respects, yes, there would be a big difference from a repeal of key provisions of the ACA, but I think we're headed in those directions to some extent anyway. I mean, one more example of this is the individual mandate if President Obama is reelected, and let's say as well, which seems iffy right now, that the Supreme Court upholds the mandate, even in that case, I think it's going to be very difficult to implement. I mean, it's not that strong of a mandate to begin with. It's phased in over a couple of years with just a small penalty in the first year. And if we aren't sort of fully up to speed and ready to roll in every state on time next fall of 2013 is when people would need to make their decisions about enrollment. If there's some confusion about who's eligible for what subsidy, if there's some confusion about what plans will be available, if the cost of some of the plans aren't quite as low as some people had hoped for, one could easily see Congress on, maybe with President Obama's support, pushing back that deadline for an individual mandate penalty, not necessarily not going ahead with the whole law, but it does mean that Congress is going to be revisiting these issues. It gets into this must-pass category of legislation, and it brings me to an area where I think there is potential for a lot of bipartisan interest, and that is in how do you make competitive health insurance plans work without a mandate. So that's where the Republicans are very clearly want to go. I think for the reasons I just described, that's where the Democrats, even if they stay in control, are de facto going to have to think about going. That's where we're going to go if the Supreme Court tells us to go there. And there are some good models for at least starting to work through those problems. One of them actually comes in something kind of like premium support that's already in Medicare, and that's the Medicare Part D program, which is a bunch of competing private plans without a mandate, with subsidies from the government that seniors choose between for their drug coverage. And drug coverage, I can tell you, when this program was started in 2006, was viewed as a part of health care coverage that would not work as a standalone insurance benefit. It was too predictable. But between subsidies, risk adjustment, other steps like reinsurance to protect high-cost beneficiaries and to encourage plans to design benefits to attract those beneficiaries, steps like limited open enrollment periods, late enrollment penalties, it's actually working pretty well, and I think kind of got the ultimate compliment in the ACA, which was not to be repealed or overturned, as people are talking about with the ACA, but to be built upon and expanded. There are some reasons to think that whoever wins, they're going to have to find some ways to work together. And that brings me to the last point I wanted to make, kind of going beyond the ACA on this must-pass legislation. And I think Alice articulated this really well, which is the overall very frightening deficit and fiscal outlook for the long term. Congress did deal with that in a limited way last summer when they had to, when they were facing the debt limit vote and expansion. They came close, somewhat close at least, to potentially a bigger deal. There's a foundation to build on there, and frankly, I think some of the best opportunities for Medicare reform, entitlement reform, maybe next steps with Medicaid and with coverage more generally may come in the context of a broader tax reform debate that would get into some of these issues, like broadening the base, as Paul Ryan has proposed. It may be difficult to come together, but I think we're going to have that discussion early next year between the fiscal cliff and the expiration of all of the tax cut provisions from the Bush era. That together means that both sides really have incentives to try to get together and do something on these problems, and it should be interesting to see what that turns out to be.
Definitely. Okay, so let's talk about Ross's paper now, which is about the obesity problem and how significant a driver of healthcare costs it really is. Far more significant than I think most people realize, and how important it will be for the next president to tackle that if they really want to get healthcare costs down. But then it begs the question: what do you do about it? What can you do about it? How can you actually head it off before it happens?
Sure. Well, thank you. And I've been following this conversation very intently. It's very interesting. And I agree certainly that taxes and deficits are important and that who's covered by insurance is important. But fundamentally, what a major driver of healthcare costs is who gets sick, what they get sick with, and what outcomes they experience. That's really fundamental. And I think from that perspective, that perhaps the largest threat facing this country on healthcare really is the obesity epidemic. And let me tell you why I think that. It's now the case that 2/3 of all American adults and 1/3 of all American children are overweight. So the majority of adults and a large percentage of children are overweight. And being overweight or obese puts you at much, much higher risk for cardiovascular disease, for diabetes, for several kinds of cancer, for asthma, for arthritis, for a long list of other conditions, many of which are chronic conditions. They're things that require treatment over a long period of time through your life course. And that leads to very much higher costs, medical costs associated with treatment of long-term chronic conditions. By many estimates, medical spending in the overweight and the obese is as much as 100% higher than that of people who are healthy weight. And I think the best recent estimate I've seen is that at least 21% of all U.S. healthcare spending is driven by the obesity epidemic. 21%. And that's a number that's increased substantially just in the last decade, and it could easily increase in the decades to come if we don't do a better job of controlling this epidemic. There's also the issue that chronic diseases are occurring earlier and earlier in children now. We're having type 2 diabetes, which used to be called adult onset diabetes, cropping up in teenagers and even younger children. And there's a new estimate out on the street that one in every three children born in the U.S. today will develop diabetes in their lifetime. And one in every two Latino or African-American children will develop diabetes in their lifetime. Let me say that again. One in every two children born today. That's a huge number of people who will have diabetes. That's going to be a major driver of healthcare costs, no matter who's insured or not insured. That's going to be something that we have to do something about as a country. And there's new evidence that children who are born today may, in fact, have a shorter life expectancy than their parents for the first time in many, many, many years in this country. So what does this all mean on the cost side? It means that prevention is going to be extremely important. Obesity in particular is something for which prevention is critical because obesity is very hard to treat once it's entrenched. There are physiological reasons for that and behavioral reasons for that. And we have to catch it early. And the antecedents of obesity actually start in childhood. So that's the right place to focus. Prevention can also lead to huge cost savings. By one estimate, just a 5% decrease in the amount of diabetes in this country would save $25 billion a year, every year. If it was a 10% decrease, an even bigger number. So prevention can have real action on the healthcare cost side. And as you alluded to earlier, prevention is not easy necessarily, but it does have some advantages in the sense that a lot of the most effective prevention strategies bypass gridlock at the federal level of policy and are about what happens at the community level and the individual level and the state level. And there's a lot more that can be done there that avoids some of the pitfalls of bipartisan gridlock that's on a much smaller scale, but that ultimately makes, I would argue, an even bigger difference in the ultimate healthcare cost outcomes that this country faces, as well as our overall competitiveness internationally by having a healthy and productive workforce.
Well, let me ask you about that. So how do you tackle this? I mean, there's public education campaigns, sure. But, you know, how do you get people to listen? Mm-hmm. And then you also talk a little bit in your paper about sort of integrating approaches across a variety of policy areas that you don't think of just in healthcare, education, housing, some others. Maybe you talk a little bit about that because it's a little hard to picture how all of these things would
sure.
come together.
Well, so fundamentally, the drivers of things like obesity are very simple. Obesity is about energy imbalance. Energy in, energy out. More energy comes in than goes out, you gain weight. That's what obesity is about. But unfortunately, the drivers of energy in, of what you eat, are actually very complex. There's a lot of complex biology, and we live in a very complex environment, a social environment, a physical environment, an advertising environment, markets that our forces are at work. And so trying to understand how all these things fit together has been challenging for scientists because these are different fields of science that aren't used to talking to each other. Geneticists and economists don't usually sit around discussing issues like obesity, but they need to, and they have started to increasingly. But it also means that our policies have to be quite coordinated across many different sectors that play a role in the obesity epidemic. We know a lot of things that work in isolation, but the trick will be doing them all at the same time and in a coordinated way. And a lot of my work over the last couple of years with NIH and the CDC and the Institute of Medicine has been about finding these tools that will allow us to anticipate how all these different pieces of the puzzle fit together and to coordinate our policy efforts across many different sectors and many different levels, the local level, the community level, the federal level, to try to actually have a cohesive, holistic, systemic approach to this problem, because I think that's what it's going to take to make more progress.
And how much can a president do about this? Because, you know, you kind of think, well, there's bully pulpit, and then there's, you know, pass legislation, but good luck with that. We're gridlocked, right? You know,
there are a bunch of things that I think a president can do in particular that I lay out in my paper. And I think one of those things that's absolutely fundamental is to invest in biomedical research and public health research, because this is a very, very hard problem. It's one that's not going away. It's one that's increasingly a worldwide problem, and we need to understand it better, and we need to understand what to do about it better very urgently. And so cutting NIH funding is not the way to go about understanding it better. Increasing it would be. So that's a fundamental thing a president can do. Another thing a president can do is to help raise awareness about this issue. The president has an awfully large bully pulpit. The First Lady, the current First Lady, has done a lot to raise awareness on these issues. I think a president should continue to put both the idea that prevention is important and that obesity is important forward. And third, I think there's a lot of barriers in place to prevent coordination of policy at every level, including the federal level, between, say, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services. But that's the kind of coordination that we're really going to need, and that's something that the executive branch can help to facilitate.
Okay. All right. So I think we'd like to start opening up to questions from the audience. And when you speak, we're going to be bringing a mic around in a second. When you speak, we'd just like you to, you know, speak directly into the microphone so we get good, clear sound recording, and everybody can get a good view of this. Sir?
Hello. I'd like to ask the panelists whether their plans would include any role for public health clinics in the community. I raise this because I have friends and relatives working in the healthcare field, and they tell me that the emergency rooms of hospitals are full of people who would benefit from community healthcare being provided free and quickly and in a friendly manner until the problem becomes ripe for emergency care in a hospital.
Sure. The community-based interventions are really the future of healthcare. The overall trends, as Ross described, are in costs are going to be determined by things like chronic diseases that relate to obesity and other chronic diseases that can be prevented through early preventive interventions. There are a number of steps underway now that I think both parties support in different forms to try to encourage more prevention-oriented care. So in Medicare, for example, right now the Medicare program is implementing medical home initiatives and accountable care organization initiatives that try to put the focus on improving the health of the individual, not just providing more services, more, you know, treating more complications after they happen. So I think those steps are also being implemented in the private sector, implemented by employers with the goal of moving towards community-based care. It's still the case today that most of our institutions and most of our financing is kind of tied up the traditional way in dealing with these problems after they happen. But I think there are some constructive steps in the right direction. This is especially a problem for lower income and vulnerable populations who often have the worst access to health care because of low prices or because in Medicaid or because of not being covered. And when cutbacks make this kind of community care less available. Here, too, though, I think there's some good alternative models. Here at Brookings and the Engelberg Center, we've been working with several of those. Just to give you a couple of examples, in Camden, New Jersey, and now in other parts of New Jersey, a primary care physician named Jeff Brenner has started a new model for community-based care delivery for largely uninsured patients who were showing up not to get preventive care, but were showing up in the emergency room with very costly complications related to chronic diseases, mental health issues on top of it, and we're not getting any of this kind of community-based coordinated care. They've invested not just in more primary care services, but also in more like nurse practitioners, social workers in the neighborhoods, you know, not even community-based clinics, but just in the neighborhoods and housing where people are getting care. That's being financed by redirecting the money that was going into emergency care into providing coordinated support at the community level for these interventions. That requires some real changes. They've had to go through a lot of hoops in terms of everything from antitrust laws to getting bipartisan Medicaid legislation to support these coordinated efforts, these accountable care efforts in New Jersey. It's not easy, but it is happening. Another good example is in Denver, where a public entity called Denver Health provides services for low-income and uninsured people in the community, and they've been able to do that and sustain it and actually be a leader in quality improvement and applying manufacturing processes like Toyota Lean Production to healthcare, you know, leader for our whole healthcare system by redirecting how the money flows. So instead of, again, going to treating complications after it happens, they have capitated payments in many cases. They get overall budgets from the city and from other sources that they are accountable for in terms of getting better population health results. So these should be key parts of healthcare reform. There are some good examples of this happening around the country, and hopefully we will see more of it. I think these are things that, again, both parties can find ways to support.
But it's not in the current legislation.
It's not. There's certainly much more needs to be done compared to what's in current legislation.
Well, let me just add to that. I agree with Mark entirely that the community level is absolutely fundamental to solving a lot of these issues, and I think it actually goes beyond clinics as one form of community intervention. I think a lot of what happens in communities, whether it's social support, whether it's the environment, the physical environment, opportunities for physical activity, opportunities to access healthy food, and social norms are really fundamental to health outcomes, and there's a lot that can be done at the community level going well beyond the actual healthcare arena.
Hi, Mike Miller. I'm a physician and health policy consultant analyst, wannabe wonk. I want to sort of tie together a couple of things, what Ross said about obesity and then sort of some of the other things about the healthcare deficit projections and things. Because something I did in a meeting a while ago talked to somebody about that, you know, the projections are our best estimates, our best guesses. They're not fait accompli. And one of the things Ross brought up about obesity, I just read recently something about how trans fat blood levels in Americans have dropped dramatically in the last few years. And I got to attribute that to the labeling and the awareness of people. And I'm sure 5-7 years ago when the FDA regulations were requiring trans fat labeling that led to food companies marketing, you know, no trans fats or anything else, I'm 99.9% sure that CBO didn't score that as a cost saving or effective estimated any effects it's going to have on obesity. So, I mean, there's other nutritional food factors, and, you know, Ross talked about the energy balance is what causes obesity. You know, it's what we put in our pie hole versus everything else that happens to us that determines whether we become obese as a country or as individuals. Can you guys talk a little bit more about, you know, factors, whether it's food and changes in the farm bill, which may or may not be a bipartisan deal, or it's sort of stuck right now, as I understand, or some of the healthcare things that may go along that may not get adequately, may not be scorable, but may have a significant impact on our healthcare spending, our healthcare financial situation, whether it's for Medicare or in the private sector? Thank you.
From my perspective, certainly what happens in agriculture, what happens in housing, what happens in education, and what happens in healthcare are all very closely related, and it's pretty hard to think about what will happen to healthcare and obesity in particular in this country in the future without thinking about tax policy, food policy, agricultural policy, transportation policy, because these are fundamental drivers.
But a lot of it comes back to the community.
Sure.
And we haven't talked much about exercise, but that's got to be a very big component. And schools have been cutting back on exercise programs and exercise facilities, and that needs to be reversed. They need to do more. It doesn't have to be fancy. They just got to get the kids moving around.
David, could I just say a word? I mean, I'm struck by the incredibly constructive initiatives underway within Medicare, within Medicaid. I mean, we're seeing a transformation in many respects in the nature of these programs in an effort to to grapple with them, and the growing realization that some forms of community clinics, facilities, different kinds of treatment of care instead of reimbursing cost of for expenditures. I mean, all of this is immensely encouraging, and I think if you could get politicians together out of public sight to talk about these and deal with them, you could. There, I talked to a lot of Republicans, and it's true. Most of them are former. If we could get Alan Simpson and Pete Domenici sort of back, you know, now it'd be a lot easier. But the problem is the debate occurring nationally is utterly divorced from all of the constructive things occurring underneath. And sadly, sometimes it's that debate that's cutting budgets for the very kind of initiatives that both of you are talking about, where government is seen as a problem, and therefore it certainly can't. And that's happening in states as well as in the federal government, where public employees are being demonized and government must be squeezed and limited to in ways that could sort of really kill many of these initiatives before they get up to scale. And so I do think that broader debate is important, and it's why I emphasize what I did, not to deny at all the kind of innovative work going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, can I say one more thing on this, too? I think it's a very important topic. It does seem like the healthcare debate for the fall election has reached its very high-level, fundamental, philosophical disagreement. I mean, in some ways, it's not even really about healthcare anymore. It's really about what the role of federal government is or should be in American life. And that's just an issue that Americans right now do seem to really differ on, at least as reflected in some of the supporters of Republicans versus Democrats on these issues. I think to put together what Tom said with what I was trying to emphasize, with all these things that are going on, in many cases are not happening at the federal level but are happening in states, both Republican and Democratic states, and in local governments on places like Colorado, is that these are must-address issues. So we are going to continue to have this philosophical debate about the role of federal government, I think, for a while. Your views may differ, but I don't think that's going to be settled in the November election. I think that's still going to be with us. I think the important thing beyond that is that there are some models and examples of being able to address these very serious issues in healthcare and in our nation's fiscal outlook more generally. We may be doing it because we're up against the wall of must-pass legislation. We may be doing it for reasons other than, you know, just happy talk getting together. But I think it is going to continue to happen because these fundamental issues must be addressed. We cannot afford the kinds of obesity trends that we were just hearing about. We cannot afford to keep doing what we've been doing in Medicare and Medicaid. It's going to change.
I'm Dr. Susan Blumenthal. I served as Assistant Surgeon General, and now I'm Director of Health and Medicine at the Center for the Study of the Presidency. I just want to kind of echo some of the points that were being made here. Public health has been a major driver of increased life expectancy. We've almost doubled life expectancy in one century. We have safe food, safe water, and access to health care in greater numbers now as a result of investments in government-sponsored programs. However, we spend only 3 to 5% of our $2.6 trillion healthcare budget on prevention and public health. The ACA included in it a prevention and public public wellness fund, which is now going to be plucked under current proposals to pay for food stamps, for example. It's low-hanging fruit. And the idea was to do what you were saying, is to create health and all policy solutions that we need at the table, which the White House has done, created a task force on obesity that cross-cuts all of the major departments of government, because health can no longer be in the province of the health department. It has to involve all of the agencies of government working with the private sector, because for those of us trained in medicine, we can't change obesity one person at a time. We have to do it with systemic public health community-based interventions. But if we're going to put health into the health system and not have it be a sick care system, then we need these kinds of innovations like the prevention fund, which is being targeted for extinction. We can't do it just by talking about it. We need the support, the innovation, and the cross-cutting approaches that were described.
Yeah, I would like to throw that out to the panel, because you're right, that is the backdrop of all this that we're talking about. You know, the Prevention and Public Health Fund is now being targeted as a slush fund. It was used as the...
Already been raided.
You know, so you know, how do you, or is it possible to change that debate with the fund the way it exists now? Does it have to be changed in some major way if it doesn't get cut out first? You know, how do we kind of get beyond this sort of, you know, the tone of the discussion that we're having now to talk about what's
needed?
And it
was a $15 billion fund. So, I mean, it's, you know, that was a significant amount of investment in prevention, mm-hmm. which is being eradicated.
Yeah. Good point.
No, I just I think any of these sort of standalone proposals, whether it's a prevention fund, whether it's an add-on for, you know, studying the healthcare workforce and so on, those are pretty easy targets in an increasingly tight fiscal era. And I think that goes back to what much of the panel agrees on, from what I can tell, which is that prevention and public health and community-based care need to not be an add-on in the form of a fund, but need to be much more integral to the way that we're financing healthcare, the way that we're regulating healthcare itself. And, you know, that's why I think that maybe the more promising steps for the long term are things like building in the goal of keeping patients healthy into our payment systems in Medicare and into our benefit designs that employers are offering, and steps like that really get are intended to get directly at public health in healthcare, as you were saying.
Right. And I think the ACA had those elements in it. It had incentives for employers to start workplace programs. It has a national strategy for prevention. The accountable care organizations are aimed at doing just that, but that's once people are sick. I mean, the idea is to have also prevention programs to stop, I mean, that's primary prevention, is, as you know, is not getting sick in the first place. So I agree. I mean, it has to be integrated into the system. I think for the first time, this bill was really trying to create a prevention transformation and with a number of different and preventive services, you know, that it paid without cost sharing and without deductible. And already 82 million people have benefited from free preventive services. That's early detection, so that's secondary prevention. But I think there was a gamut, a spectrum of interventions that were included to kind of create this transformation from a sick care system to a health system.
Back there with...
Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. My question is about a study that came out from the Commonwealth Fund yesterday. Commonwealth Fund is well established, respected in healthcare reform. The basis of both the Republican plan and the Affordable Care Act is that people ask for too many services because they're free at the point of delivery, and we have to reduce overutilization. What the Commonwealth Fund did, what they said, looking at plans in Europe and Japan, was that a big problem, the most important reason our health care costs so much more than it does in Europe is because the prices are much higher. And I was wondering from Ms. Rivlin and from Dr. McClellan if they're planning to integrate this into their thinking about health care reform.
This study came out yesterday. I have not seen it, but the last point you made is clearly right. One of the reasons that uh, we have 17, now almost 18% of our GDP going into healthcare, is that our healthcare is expensive, and one of the reasons for that is we use specialists a lot more and we pay them more compared to other countries. Now, I don't know exactly how you turn that around, except by some of the things we were talking about earlier, emphasizing primary care and prevention, and trying to train people in different approaches to use of the healthcare workforce. Some of the things Mark was talking about.
Yeah, I guess I'd agree with that, and add to it that according to the study, the prices here are higher. I mean, that's not new news. Everybody, most people in this audience and around the world know that for say brand name drugs, our prices are higher than just about any other country. The same thing is true, by the way, for physician services, hospital services, you name it. There's some questions about what exactly is being measured, like what happens during a hospital day here in the U.S. is a lot more intensive than what happens in a hospital day elsewhere, and some things that maybe really are differences in intensity, if not quality of care, get captured as price in some of these measurement comparisons. But you know, there's something real going on there. I think the bigger issue, to Alice's point, is can we get more not only more meaningful prices, but more meaningful action to bring down the prices. And that goes to things like, I think, what you were mentioning, third-party payment and care that's free at the point of use. People don't care about the prices that much. And in most cases, people don't even know what they are when they're getting care. And there are a lot of initiatives underway now to create more meaningful transparency, not just to give people a bunch of price lists, but to give them the information that they really need to make better decisions about their care. This has happened in prescription drugs, where we have the highest brand name prices in the world, but we also have the lowest generic prices in the world because of a really effective generic competition system. And what really made those prices matter in terms of care was when people started getting drug benefits where they could save a lot of money themselves. It didn't just go to some third-party insurers when they switched from a brand to a generic. So in Medicare today, close to 80% of all prescriptions are generic, and that's had a huge impact on Medicare's drug costs compared to, just 5 years ago when it was closer to 50% generic. That same thing is starting to happen in other aspects of healthcare where some insurers, like those that are working with Safeway in California, are providing information on the total cost of elective procedures like colonoscopies, and giving employees benefits where the plan will pay, say, $1,000 based on what's sort of looks like a reasonable cost of the procedure as it's being done around the area. And if employees want to go to a more expensive provider, they pay the difference. The converse of that is they can get a free colonoscopy if they search around for a good price and get good quality information. That's really hard to do for much of healthcare today, but I think it is changing. And my guess is that, just as Safeway found in Northern California, once you start having prices that matter and information that's meaningful to consumers that they can actually use to save money while getting better health, you're going to see those prices change. That's what happened with the colonoscopy prices, at least use with Safeway's case.
Thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I'm struck by a metaphor that seems to me that is sort of backdrop to all the components of what we've been talking about today, and that's something I know that Dr. Hammond spends a lot of his time on, and that's the notion of complex systems. And so three thoughts came to my mind. I want to throw them out and imagine that there's a question mark at the end of this. Because that's its intent. One is the notion that medicine itself, according to a number of people like David Agus and others, is moving very much in the direction of complex systems practice, from treatment orientation to preventative orientation and use of proteomics and things of that sort. And so what impact might that have on all of the things that we're talking about today? The second is the kinds of programs that people like Michael Dell have instituted, the Well at Dell program, that because the private sector is the place where this is one of the places where the profit motive can be very helpful because they've got real profit incentives to do something about it and start with their own workforce. And the notion that that might, I won't say metastasize, but, you know, spread elsewhere. And the third, is what role social media can have in the sort of more than the educational component, but including the educational component that, for example, can get at things like obesity. I'm imagining what would have been like how the movement against cigarette smoking might have moved differently and much faster if social media had been around when that was first beginning to be tackled. So all of that said, it's the notion that the complex systems are sort of the backdrop to all of this. They have everything to do with the practice of medicine, the increasing role of private sector in driving down the causes of this, and the role that social media might play in it.
Yeah. I agree with you entirely that complex systems are an appropriate backdrop for this, and that is an area I spend a lot of my time thinking about and that my training is in. I think two things, I'll let my colleagues also respond. One of them is that you're absolutely right that social media is very transformative in this space. I'm engaged in several projects, both that use data from social media to understand the choices that people are making and how those are informed by their context better, and that use social media as a tool to reach people and to change minds and to educate in this space. So I think that's absolutely fundamental. And two, the bad news about complex systems is that they're complex and hard to disentangle. But the good news is that if you do understand them, you can have a lot of change by moving only a little bit. So tipping is a phenomenon that's a hallmark of complex systems, and that's something that I think is very possible in this space for policymakers if they make the right choices.
Okay, I think we have time for one more, and if we could.
Hi, I'm Mark Nadell, Georgetown University. We've been talking about the medical system, but I think no one has mentioned yet the role of providers. And let me just give a little backdrop. I think all of us have been in dentist's office. You see Washingtonian Magazine. And the most striking thing to me about Washingtonian Magazine is the page after page of advertisements from plastic surgeons, which tells me that there are too many residency slots for plastic surgery if you have to advertise to that extent. And we also hear that there is an increasingly insufficient number of primary care physicians. And, of course, you know, we all know that they are undercompensated by Medicare and by private insurance for the time they put in. Is there, regardless of what's on the table now, this is really directed at Tom, do you think there's a chance in hell that Congress could get in the business putting more force or some sort of almost rationing behind residency slots so that we get more of what we need and less of what's costing us the proverbial arm and leg?
He answered his own question. Bruce, let Mark answer this question. He knows enough to get it right.
Well, I don't know about that, but I know enough to have an opinion. Rationing of residency slots can only take you so far. We do have slots are effectively rationed. You know, the federal government pays through Medicare, in some sense through Medicaid, for graduate medical education, and those slots are allocated by specialty. And, oh, yeah, they're a lot more subsidized in primary care than there are in plastics. Interesting, if you look the last few years, I think it's the very hardest residency slot to match in is in plastics. It's up there with dermatology and much further down towards the bottom, but coming up is primary care. And I think that's not so much a function of the residency slot policy as it is a function of just the lifestyle and practice associated with these different specialties. And you know, I know we've talked a lot about the need for more, you know, kind of government intervention and so forth, and in supporting primary care. But you know, plastics does not get much coverage right now. It's largely, at least for cosmetic surgery, it's outside of what's covered by third-party insurance and Medicare. And I think the, you know, the reason that you see a lot of those ads is number one, there's a lot of competition that goes on intended to be on quality and price. You know, unlike many aspects of care, when you get your plastic surgery, you get kind of an all-in price along with some evidence of, you know, what either from friends and the people who contribute to Washingtonian Magazine, they have ratings for these guys, or more objective measures of the quality of the procedure that you're getting, and you know, in some ways, it's moved in the direction that we'd like to see elsewhere in terms of price transparency and information on quality that's being presented to patients. It's much tougher in primary care. The payment rates have been lower historically. That's hopefully changing with some of the reforms that we described, and the role and the lifestyle for primary care doctors will hopefully improve as well. One of the things that Blue Cross of Massachusetts has noted since implementing some of their ACO type reforms, which started with a kind of a big medical home additional payment to primary care doctors, plus a lot more support and in terms of data on their patients and how they were getting care and backup from nurse practitioners and the like, was that the quality of life of the primary care physicians involved improved, as did their financing. And so it's turning out to be a very popular program in Massachusetts. And I think that's the way to make primary care more popular. And hopefully some of these reforms that we've talked about today, and I'd argue both presidential candidates one way or another, are going to have to find ways to make progress on that.
All right. And with that, I think we have reached the end of our time. But I'd like to give a big thanks to all of our panelists for taking the time to come here and mix it up. And it's been a great discussion. Thanks to the Brookings Institution for putting this on, and please try to join us for the next discussion in the Campaign 2012 series. And thanks a lot.